Thanks to NIOSH and others for the opportunity to present our work. This is the work that I did during my PhD with Martin Wood at the University of Western Ontario. Right now I'm working on a different subject for my postdoc on quantum simulation, actually. So Dickey's superradiance is a well-known phenomena for physicists, and it has been observed in many experiments over the past few decades. So physicists, they know very well about this phenomena. It's well studied. But before our papers and before this work, it was never applied to astrophysics. Before I start giving an introduction to Dickey's superradiance, so I will briefly discuss masers that are known to astronomers, and they have been detected in different, like in the interstellar medium and other regions. And I will base my introduction for Dickey's superradiance on discussion, a maser discussion. And after giving a brief introduction, I will discuss Dickey's superradiance in astrophysics and some observational evidences for superradiance in these mazing regions. And then I will talk about our superradiance model, and in the end, I will wrap up everything with some examples of applying superradiance to fast radio bursts. So before I talk about superradiance, I kind of, let's just quickly review masers. The reason that...
hockey stick, I don't know if you want. As a pointer?
Yeah. It's bigger than
Is
me.
Okay.
So they will be. Masers and superradiance, as you will see later, they have some similarities. And we did our search for superradiance in these regions. But these two are fundamentally two different phenomena. But I start with this, and then I slowly go into superradiance. Masers are actually some burst events in astrophysics. And the word maser stands for microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. In order to have amplification by stimulated emission mechanism, you need to have inverted population. What do I mean from inverted population or inverted medium? In a normal medium where we have thermodynamic, local thermodynamic equilibrium, the population of the different energy levels obey Boltzmann equation as we have it here, meaning that if you have two energy levels and one has higher energy, the number of atoms or molecules that they basically occupy that energy is going to be lower. But in an inverted medium, a higher energy level can have more occupation than a lower energy level. So naturally, the local thermodynamic equilibrium doesn't apply in that medium. So we are focused in this non-LTE medium that where we can have inverted kind of population, so we can amplify the radiation by this stimulated emission process. So what happens in this medium is that through some collision or radiative mechanism, the population in a lower energy level is pumped to a higher energy level, so we achieve the inversion. And after some time, eventually, spontaneously, some of these atoms, they are going to decay to the ground state and they will emit a photon. This photon, known as seed photon, is going to propagate in the medium. And as it encounters other excited atoms, it's going to stimulate emission of similar photons with exactly the same phase, the same frequency, propagating in the same direction. And the output will be a very intense pulse that basically a bunch of photons that they all have, basically, they are all phase coherent, they have the same frequency and moving in the same direction. So the maser bursts, this intense radiation, is the result of this successive stimulated emission that we have this in mazing medium. The other important thing for my discussion is, if you think of these atoms as quantum systems, small quantum system, so the maser is composed of these distributed quantum systems, each kind of interacting with these photons and emitting another photon. So the maser can be described as this distributed quantum system. But what happens if we kind of look at this whole medium with this inverted atom as a single quantum system? This is what Robert Dickey did in 1954. in his seminal paper, he basically considered this gas of inverted atoms or molecules as a single quantum mechanical system. And then he calculated the radiation, the spontaneous radiation rate from such a sample that he later on called a superradiance. So here I have simplified the idea, showing one and two atoms. So if you have only one atom and the atom is in the excited level, we know from statistical physics that this atom is going to decay to the ground state, and the probability of finding the detecting a photon is going to be in the detector is going to decay exponentially. And over a time scale of tau spontaneous, there's like 70% chance you're going to see a photon, detect a photon. So this time scale that we are going to kind of detect a photon is known as tau spontaneous, the time scale of this spontaneous process for the single atom. Now, what happens if I have two of these atoms and I put them close to each other, and they're initially excited? One of these atoms is going to decay to the ground state, and the radiation from this atom is going to interact with the second atom in the excited level. But what happens? These two atoms are close to each other. So I can't distinguish which one of these atoms has radiated and which one is in the ground state, which one is in the excited state.
Is the distance between atoms shorter than the wavelength or longer than the wavelength?
So in this case, just for this example, let's start with the example that these two atoms are in a distance that is much shorter than the wavelength. So I can say, basically distinguish between them, and I can say who is radiated and who is in the excited level. So the state of such a system is basically, it can be described as an entangled kind of state where one is in the excited, the other one is in the ground, and I can distinguish between them. So what happens when the system is put in this symmetric, basically entangled state? The second atom that is still in the excited state is going to radiate, but this time faster. So if I look at the detector, the probability of detecting the second atom instead of being tau spontaneous is tau spontaneous divided by 2. So the rate is been doubled. Now imagine you have n of these atoms that are in the inverted state. So what happens if there's if these atoms, they basically, they act independently from each other in a so-called non-coherent system, what happens? Each of them, they're going to decay to the ground state and emit a photon. The radiation will be isotropic because it has the characteristic of a spontaneous emission, which is isotropic. And in the detector, you're going to kind of see that your intensity is going down exponentially over the time scale of tau spontaneous, single atom spontaneous time scale. But if these atoms are basically inverted atoms, can kind of communicate with each other through radiation field, and they can be put in a symmetric entangled state, what happens is that they will basically kind of, they're building up some kind of correlation between them. And after some time in the detector, you're going to see a burst of radiation over time scale that is n times smaller than the time scale of a single atom. That means that your radiation rate has been enhanced n times by the number of atoms or inverted molecules that you have, and the intensity, which is the total energy divided by the rate, instead of going linearly by the number of atoms, is going to go as the square of the number of atoms. This is what we call superradiance, and kind of that happens in a coherent system. So after mentioning like this main kind of properties of superradiance, I should kind of emphasize that superradiance is different from Maser. You saw that the Maser was a burst, superradiance is a burst, but these two are two fundamentally different phenomena. They have some kind of like a requirements that are in kind of in common between them, but they are two different phenomena. Superradiance would be a coherent phenomena, while Maser is a non-coherent kind of phenomena that we have. You saw that Maser is composed of this distributed kind of quantum entities, while superradiance is a single quantum mechanical system. And the main thing is superradiance intensity scales as n square, the number of inverted atoms, while Maser scales linearly. However, both Maser and superradiance, they require inverted population. So there must be a supply of kind of energy from somewhere. So the atoms must be inverted for both of them. So we thought that if there's going to be superradiance, we need inversion. And we know that inversion already exists in mesing regions. So we started our search for supergradients in mesing regions because both of them, they needed population inversion, as I mentioned, and maser and supergradients, both of them, they need high velocity coherence, meaning that if you emit a photon, yeah? So the other atom that is moving relative to this like source, this emitter, it should basically see this photon in like a kind of the velocity of this two atom is going to shift the frequency of the photon. So we want the frequency of this moving photon to match the frequency of the transition of the other atom. So we need some kind of velocity coherence. So the emitted photon from one can be seen by others and can kind of simulate emission, or in case of supergradients, can basically couple the two systems. So we need these two requirements for both maser and supergradients, but what basically distinguishes maser and supergradients is the last requirement for supergradients. And that is, in order to have coherent system, in order to have supergradients, we need to basically have all the dephasing relaxation mechanisms that are against supergradients to take place over a time scale that is much longer than the time scale of supergradients. This requirement is not needed for maser because it's a non-coherent system. But like kind of to rephrase my thing is that imagine that I'm basically in a supergradient system, the atoms are establishing coherence and they're going to emit over a time scale that we basically call a TR, and that's like tau spontaneous divided by N. So this is the time scale that takes for your system to go coherent. If there are any other phenomena that they are going to disturb your system and they happen faster than this coherence can be established, they're going to basically weaken or terminate the coherent process. So I come and kind of associate a time scale to this phenomena that they work against supergradients, and I want them to be very slow so the system can develop. This can build up this coherence, and we can have supergradients. So we say that the time scale of supergradients, TR, which I call a characteristic time of supergradients, and TD, which I will introduce later, should be smaller than all the dephasing times in my environment. So after the requirements are met, then we can basically the supergradients in SUS. Here I show the example of a small sample supergradients, which is basically the ideal or perfect supergradients that Dickey used in 1954 to introduce supergradients. So what do I have here? First of all, what do I mean from a small sample? It means that all the inverted atoms molecule are within a volume that is so much smaller than the wavelength of the radiation that is interacting with the atoms. That's the definition of a small sample. My example is like 75 hydrogen, neutral hydrogen atoms that are interacting with 21 centimeter line radiation, and they are all contained inside a cube that the length is 4 centimeter. That's like fifth of lambda. Here I show the supergradients intensity of such a sample, which is normalized to the number of my hydrogen atoms times I non-coherent, which is basically in the intensity of such a system if it was going to go non-coherent, if it was going to emit non-coherently. And I'm plotting it versus time in second. So as I mentioned, when this system, this is a small sample, all the inverted atoms, they basically radiate coherently, or when I have supergradients, I'm expecting to see a burst of radiation, a very directional kind of burst. And in my detector, I'm gonna see a spike of basically energy as you see it here. The time scale of this burst, as I showed as TR, is basically the time scale of a single, the time scale of a spontaneous emission for a single atom divided by the number of atoms. And this spike of energy takes place after some delay that I call a TD, and is proportional to the TR and the number of inverted atoms. So what do we have here? We see that these 75 atoms, inverted atoms, they basically wait. And they together, they suddenly they decay to the ground state, and the output is a burst of energy. And if you look at it, it peaks. The peak scales to one. That means that the intensity of this supergradient sample is n times the intensity of non-coherent thing. And because the intensity of the non-coherent system scales as n, so we can see clearly in the perfect superradiance system that ISR is proportional to n squared. The other thing is, just to kind of visualize this thing better, is if I had these 75 atoms in my system and they were going to radiate non-coherently, what would have happened in my detector was that I would have had an exponential decay that was basically the maximum intensity was 75 times smaller than this, and it would have basically taken place over a time scale that was 75 times longer if I had a non-coherent system. So this, the coherence in this system basically squeezes the time scale of the event. And when, because of conservation of energy, if you squeeze the time scale, you're going to basically go with a higher spike and larger intensity. So this example that I showed here is the ideal superradiance. Sure.
So this the denominator in this what you're plotting, is that the constant or just is the exponential?
So because I am showing the hydrogen 21 centimeter line, so I am showing the real time scale for this transition.
But I'm saying in your vertical axis, the denominator,
oh, yeah,
is that a constant or is it time dependent thing? This I not coherent.
That's a constant.
That's just a constant.
N is the number of inverted atoms. I non-coherent is the maximum non-coherent intensity that you can achieve in this sample.
That's time zero, I guess. That's,
yeah, that's the time. That's right at the start because yeah, it goes exponentially down. So, yeah?
How wide is the energy spectrum of this emission? Did you look at that?
Sorry?
If you look at the energy spectrum of these emitted photons, or like, is it like monochromatic? Just that when you want to determine those, given some width in the energy spectrum.
So what happens is that if you have basically a very long time scale, you inverse it and go to the Fourier space and look at the spectra. So for a long non-coherent system, the decay, so you're going to have a narrower bandwidth in the Fourier space for your spectra. But when I squeeze the time scale through this superradiance phenomena, I'm going to have a wider bandwidth in my spectra. So it's monochromatic in a sense that you have the 21 centimeter line, and basically these atoms are basically interacting with this 21 centimeter kind of thing. But if you look at your Fourier space, you know, if you reverse the kind of the temporal width, then the bandwidth is going to be basically wider than it would have been for the non-coherent system. If I base my discussion on that the non-coherent system for the 21 centimeter, that's the bandwidth. So I'm going to basically make it broader by this.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, if you want to do the Fourier analysis for your signal, but I meant like, so you have some emission and you can, like, if you can, like, measure the energy spectrum of these emitted photons.
If it's going to be monochromatic, you can say that there's a central frequency, but it's broadband around that. If that's the definition of monochromatic, then yes. But if you are asking if there will be isolated, like basically wave packets here and there, no. I would say that would actually depend on your environment and Doppler kind of broadening and other things too. But from just the theoretical perspective, I would say that there's a central frequency that is broadened. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not up to speed on Dickey superradiance. I'm wondering, how sensitive is that effect to Doppler broadening? So you've got gas and everything's flying around.
Yeah.
You're going to get some detuning.
Yeah.
To Doppler broadening.
Yes.
How sensitive is it to that?
So as I mentioned here, in the requirement of superradiance, the velocity coherence, that is basically takes care of that part. Masers, they need the same thing, yeah? Because if because of Doppler broadening, if the frequency is kind of out of like the bin that your atom is gonna see and interact, the stimulated emission process can take place. But we know that this velocity coherence, you basically can be achieved in this regions in the interstellar medium. And if it's the Doppler broadening effects are dominant, they will go in the category of like this dephasing. And the effect can kind of basically ensue. But the whole condition that I have here assumes that the Doppler broadening is not so severe that it will allow me to basically have the superradiance. And I will show some real examples that you will see basically the velocity width that we have in these samples for masers and for FRBs. So what I showed for a small sample was the perfect superradiance. As you saw, the intensity scales as n squared. And all the sample was contained within this lambda cube, smaller than lambda cube. But we know it's very difficult to basically have such a system in the laboratory. So the first experiments in superradiance, they were in optical domain, and you can't basically squeeze many atoms within the like a lambda cube. So what happened? They extended the analysis to the so-called large sample, meaning that the volume of sample is much bigger than lambda cube. So you have a distributed system. The limitation on the volume is removed. What happens is that, so as you would expect, the superradiance or this coherent phenomena will be a little weakened. So the intensity that was going as n square now is going to be kind of it's going to be weaker than what we saw for n square, but it will still be higher than the non-coherent system intensity that we would expect. So this is what I'm trying to show here in this plot, that I have, again, superradiance intensity scaled to the constant n times I non-coherent intensity versus time that is scaled to the superradiance time scale for the large sample. Take note that in this large sample, that basically here I am showing a cylindrical sample, the geometry of the sample, L length, and basically the wavelength of the radiation enters the definition of the time scale as we would expect, yeah? So here I'm showing three examples, and they are more realistic because I have included the dephasing basically phenomena that they work against superradiance. In this example, the solid line is T prime 700 TR. As I go down to the dotted line, that I have 70 TR. So as you progress, you see that the dephasing effects are becoming more important. For the solid line, here you see that I have a burst that is followed by multiple bursts. As I go to the dashed line, where the dephasing effects is more dominant, you see that the intensity peak is smaller, and the number of like this subsequent bursts is lessened. And then we see for the dotted line, I have this single burst, and there is no this followed up burst that we call them ringing. So as you increase the dephasing, and as we expect, the coherent phenomena is basically weakened, and you can basically see that in the case of extreme dephasing, it can completely wash out the coherence from my system. Somebody might ask, like, what are these followed up bursts? Imagine that I have a very long sample. In the short sample, everything was written like this cube. But if I kind of try to extend this sample, and it's like this elongated, this large cylinder that we have, so imagine that atoms here are radiating, yeah? The radiation is going to propagate, and basically, the other atoms here are basically are radiating too. So they have already radiated before these guys, and they are in the ground state. So when the radiation from this arrives, they kind of absorb it, they're repumped, and there's another burst. So imagine that you are sitting here and you are looking at the detector, and this process is continued until dephasing effects, they stop it. The other main thing here that we have is that the peak of the burst, as you can see, it scales instead of being at 1, it's 10 to the minus 3. It shows that when you go to larger samples, this correlation between the atoms, this coherence is weakened. I can have the perfect n square dependency, but still, because the number of atoms that you can squeeze within this large, very large sample is very, very big. So what the output kind of intensity that we have is still much bigger than the non-coherent intensity. So if I'm going to observe something in the interstellar medium, in the astronomical medium, because I am going to have a very large number of atoms inside my system, although this process is not the ideal superradiance, I will still have an intensity that is much higher than masers or the non-coherent kind of phenomena that I would have had there.
So I can ask a question.
Sure.
Shouldn't it be the right number be the number of atoms within the lambda cubed, or is it bigger than that? I guess I don't know.
This n that I have is the total number of inverted atoms that I have in the sample. And it doesn't have to be within lambda cubed. Because imagine this is how I basically kind of understood it myself. So imagine that I have this long sample, yeah? And you are putting your detector here. Then the radiation is basically a radiation field is kind of propagating in this sample. The atoms that are here and the atoms that are, for example, 1 lambda apart, 2 lambda apart, 3 lambda apart, they are all going to see the same field, yeah? They are indistinguishable in that sense.
Like regular lasers then in that sense, right? That wouldn't be coherent, or is it?
No, for the masers, it doesn't matter where you sit, yeah? So you can see, if you see the phase of lambda half or lambda over 4 or anything, it doesn't matter. But for superradiance, basically, this spacing relative to the lambda kind of assures that you can have this, basically, this coherent phenomena that you want to have it. So my point is...
But it wouldn't be coherent, because, I mean, if they're longer, farther than the wavelength, then, I mean, they would be oscillating... I'm not quite sure. I mean, they wouldn't be at the same phase.
They will be in the same phase. So if I take your hockey stick, so imagine that... So this is the atom that you have here, and there is another one that as I'm holding it. Because of the retardation effect, yeah? So this one is emitting, and the photon when it... And this is, let's say, 1 lambda apart. When the photon arrives here, it's going to have the same phase that it had here. And in 2 lambda, it's going to have the same phase as here and there. And you're going to have a bunch of these atoms that they are going to see, to basically see each other, to see this velocity coherence. And we need to... It's a little more complicated because when you emit and the radiation is propagating within that angle, your diffraction angle, basically all these atoms that are sitting here, they are going to have the memory, the phase, the memory of the phase of that radiation. So, but for Maser, we don't need that kind of requirement. Maser is phase coherent in a sense that I said the stimulated photon has the same phase as the other one, meaning that the k vector is the same. It's basically propagating in the same direction. It has the same frequency, but it doesn't have this coherence that we need for this entanglement that we need to have here. And the delay time here, it kind of, again, depends on TR for the large sample. So now we have defined this TR, this TD for this large sample, which are more realistic sample, and I will use them later on for these astronomical evidences that I will show. After kind of giving this introduction, I move to some...
So yeah. You had log of n before, and now you have log of n squared. So what's the difference?
So what is this TD? Is basically the time that it takes for you to reach the maximum kind of intensity. So imagine that you have a ladder, yeah? So in the highest level, all the atoms are inverted. In the second one, all the atoms except one. In the third one, all the atoms except two. Until you reach the middle one, that half of the atoms are inverted, half of the atoms are in the lower level. And that's where you see the maximum. So if you calculate the time scale, the rate, the transition rate from the first to the second, from second to the third, and you add them up, you're going to find TD, yeah? So if you calculate this for a large sample, the transition rate for each of them, you see that it is scaled as 1 over square root of n. But for a small sample, it's so much kind of, the symmetry is higher.
But I guess the square of the log is the one that I'm puzzled by, because before you didn't have the square of the log, and now you have a square of the log, right? Is that...
But I didn't have a square root of n.
No, but...
Yeah, and here I have a square root of n. So there I had this one. So I have ln of n.
Yeah.
And here I have ln square, basically a square root of n. And if you write n as n to the power of 1/2, and then you bring it...
No, but that becomes just a factor. That doesn't give you a square. That's it. There's a... I'm just wondering, is that a typo, or is there really a difference?
No, it's not a typo. It's a difference that we calculated that way.
So there's a log, one is log of n squared, the other is log of n.
Yeah, for the large sample. And that comes from the fact that you calculate the transition rate between this ladder and add them up. And when you add them up, you see that they have this kind of log thing. So Now, if I show, like, let's show some examples that we have found in the mazing region, as I said, because the velocity coherence and population inversion is met in this region. So we started looking at them. So I'm showing basically this example. It's a recent work that we are basically, it's not finished yet. So here I have the example of S255. It's a star forming region. So it's a maser, methanol maser, 6.7 gigahertz line. So here I have the flux density in Jansky. That is basically versus time in mean Julian days. So as you can see, the data points are in black dots, and the fit, the subgradient fit that we made to the data is shown in blue. So we basically looked at this, and we saw that, okay, we have this burst that is taking place over some 100 days or so, like a couple of hundred days. And if you compare it to the examples of subgradients that I showed for the large sample and a small sample, we thought like, okay, let's apply this model to kind of disperse, because we have a spike of energy that goes from basically a few Jansky to 500 over this time scale. And if you look at the Maser theory, it's very difficult to basically show these spikes of energy. So we apply subgradients model, and as you can see, it basically captures the kind of the width and the shape of the pulse very well. The model that we have made is using these parameters that shows that subgradient samples, where the kind of we have this subgradient characteristic time scale of half a day, can basically reproduce this kind of burst in those environments, while the sample size is like on the order of 150 AU for densities that where I have like one atom per centimeter cube. Inverted population for the whole velocity span. And if I want to take into account the Doppler broadening for that velocity beam that I can see the Maser or subgradients, that basically translates to kind of 10 to the minus 12 at inverted atom per centimeter cube. That's a very low density, but remember that these samples are very large, and that accounts for a very high number of atoms that will still produce a very high intensity. The fits were basically produced here, as I'm trying to show in this lower plot. So this is a mazing region, and there was some inversion in the medium, some constant level of inversion. So we had this maser going on, and then somehow, for a change in pumping kind of condition that we have in the environment, if we can have a spike in the inversion level in the environment, that basically kind of allows for the system to kind of show this coherent behavior and results in this burst as you can see it. So here I showed that initially I have like this one atom, like 10 to the minus 12 atom per centimeter cube, and an increase in the pumping level where the inverted population is tripled, yeah? It can result in that kind of burst in my mazing region. So how can I increase this to triple it? I will need a pumping rate that goes as like basically inverting one atom or molecule per year that can kind of lead to that increase in the level of inversion and result in that kind of burst. Yes?
Sorry, what does the pumping?
What does the pumping, what is it? Or like a... So for maser, you need, for a simulated emission, you need inversion. You need more atoms or molecules in the excited level. That can happen through collisions, or it can happen through radiative pumping. In the case of like star-forming regions, for methanol masers, for example, it's like we know that there's a share of radiative pumping, or somehow like there are some collisions. So any of this mechanism that can kind of take the population from a lower level and put it in a higher kind of like a energy level, or kind of inverse the population can do this. So we think that in this environment, which was mazing for a long time before this burst happens, because this is this lower level that you see here, it's not actually zero. There is some small Jansky kind of radiation because of the maser going on. And then the flux density suddenly is increased like 150 or 200 Jansky. And we think that this initial, basically the background maser that we had was as a result of this inversion that we had in the environment. But somehow conditions change in the environment. And the pump, you know, we have a stronger pump, so it can kind of lift and increase the number of inverted atoms or molecule. And when the number of atoms or molecule is increased, because as you saw, my TR that I had here, it is basically proportional to 1 over n that we had the number of inverted atoms. So when the number of inverted atoms is increased, your TR goes down. So the time that it takes for coherence to be to develop is shorter. So if there are some dephasings in my environment that are fast and they don't let for this coherent phenomena to basically pursue, what happens is that if you increase the pump, the inversion goes up, the time that it takes for coherence to be established goes down, and you can win over those dephasing effects. So we think there's, in the background, there's a measure, there's a change in the pump, and then it results through this coherent phenomena, it results in this burst of energy. And we basically, for that, we don't need much. You have this this inversion going on, and you just double or triple it, sure.
So what's the time scale for collisions in this very low density environment?
So I didn't put the dephasing time here, but just to give you some idea, the collision that we have in the astronomical medium, the rate is very, you know, it's not that high. So you have a collision every 100 years, yeah? Every few hundred years. So that's that a year is 10 to the 7 second, yeah? So I have a burst, and this burst, as you can see, my TR is on the order of day, so it's 10 to the 5 second. So I would say that I have collisions that are on the time scale is like 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, so few years. And the collision means that's the time scale, that's the mean time between successive collision events, you know, that's what I mean.
How would such a low time scale reduce this bump, like the one that you start?
This one? This is very low too. This is 10 to the minus 19. I need a pump rate that is 10 to the minus 19. It pumps, is 10 to the minus 19 to centimeter cube second. That means that the rate, if I want to have, the inversion is 10 to the minus 12 atom per centimeter cube. So I want to invert atoms with like one atom every year, basically. So it's a low rate too. It's a low density medium. Everything is slow up there. But you see that for fast radio bursts, things change.
I'm confused about this. So if you have FRBs, and then you will associate the dispersion measure to in-situ rather than, right? That kind of...
I think you have to talk about FRBs.
Yeah,
this is a jumping gun.
Yeah, I will show you some examples, and then we can discuss it there if it doesn't kind of resolve. So here I have another example, again, for Metalnet 6.7 gigahertz Maser line. I have Cepheus A. It's a Maser region. It's a very well-known region. We have seen many Maser bursts from there. Then I show here a burst that basically takes the flux that I show here in Jansky from 0 to 3.5. So there's an increase in the intensity by few Jansky. And I have the time scale in Julian days. As you can see, this burst is basically, again, lasting for like a couple of hundred years. And the superradiant fit that we produce to these dots, to the data that we have here, is associated with superradiant samples of like 130 AU long. And the TR of this sample is like around a day again. So if you want to ask about the dephasing time, I would tell you the same number. 10 to the 6, 7 seconds. So as you can see, we had a Maser here, meaning that we started with a Maser that it basically reflects here in this constant level of inversion that I have, again, low density medium. And then if there is a change in the pump, that it can basically double the number of inverted atoms, it basically kind of reduces TR, the time scale of coherent phenomena, brings it down lower than the dephasing times, and allows for this kind of burst of radiation as we see it here. Again, the pump rate is 10 to the minus 19 per centimeter cube per second. That's the rate that you have, like kind of you're inverting an atom or molecule, one atom or molecule per year. So we had other examples for OH 1612 megahertz and the water 22 gigahertz, but I kind of would rather to show some FRB examples in the end. So just to summarize what I discussed here and how we explain it is this. So you have this amazing region, and we think it goes to superradiance. And why does that happen? We know that maser and superradiance, they both need population inversion. They need velocity coherence, but superradiance needs one more condition, and that is the time scale of superradiance should be smaller than dephasing time T prime. So I write down this time scale for kind of large sample superradiance system as you saw them before, and set them to lower than this dephasing time scale. This condition that you see up there, it kind of translates to some critical column density in an environment. So if you kind of, if your column density is lower than this critical column density, you're going to have masers, as is observed in most cases. But if you push the column density that we have there above the critical column density, this maser region is going to break up to superradiant samples, many of them. That's why we think that you see this maser going on and suddenly a change in the inversion, which is going to basically change your column density, yeah, is going to kind of affect your TR, and your TR will satisfy that top requirement. It will be smaller than the dephasing time, so you can see the coherent phenomena. That's basically the idea behind all the, this as we basically use it to explain these observations. Here, I showed the last example in masers that basically it was very difficult. It's very difficult, almost impossible to explain it within the maser theory context. The example I show here is for high mass youngest solar object, G107. The data is from Simchak paper. Here I show maser lines for, like, here I show the data for methanol 6.7 gigahertz. Shown in red, and water 22 gigahertz shown in blue. So I have the flux versus time in days. So what happens is that Simchak, they observe that they have this methanol burst, and each methanol burst is followed by a water burst. And they saw that this kind of almost periodically was repeating, but they saw that the methanol bursts are narrower than water bursts, and they pop up before water bursts. So they thought, and then they did some interferometry, kind of follow-up interferometry, and they kind of realized that the water and methanol bursts are basically coming from this same region within like a 50 parsec or something like. In astronomical scale, they are almost coming from the same area. So they thought, okay, if these are masers and there's a change in the pump, why is that triggering methanol first and then water later on? And why is it that the water burst is much broader than, it lasts longer than methanol burst? So they could not explain this within the maser theory context. So we thought, okay, we know that the duration of a burst is related to TR. We know that when the burst maximum happens, it's related to TD. So we went and we checked in our superradiance model, and we basically try to kind of calculate TR for the methanol 6.7 gigahertz line and water 22 gigahertz. So TR depends on the column density, on lambda of the wavelength of the transition, and tau spontaneous. Since these two are coming almost from the same region, it makes sense if I kind of assume that the column density of methanol and water are almost the same. So if I calculate the ratio of the TR for water 22 gigahertz to methanol 6.6 gigahertz, I see that water has, like the TR of water is 8 times larger than methanol. What does that tell us? Immediately, it says that if there is a burst of water, it's gonna be broader than methanol, yeah? And since tau D is related to TR, so what happens is that we expect that because water has a larger delay time, it should happen after methanol, and the burst should be broader than methanol. So we went, we took the data, and we tried to fit it with our superradiance model. Here, red is the methanol, blue dots are water, and the solid black line is our fit. So we, the main thing here is that we trigger superiridience simultaneously for water and methanol at this day, and then we see that since the delay time for methanol is smaller, the burst for methanol pops up first, and it's short, and after that, the water methanol pops up. So the explanation for this naturally comes out of superiridience, while Maser can't kind of explain this ordering and the difference between the temporal widths. So these are the fit parameters, the superiridian sample that can basically, they fit this data. Their time scale is on the order of hours. The examples that I showed you, they were on the order of days. The burst was lasting over like a few hundred years. Here, the burst for methanol is like 10, 12 days. For water is 40 days. And the TR naturally is shorter. So as you can see, I had this burst of few hundred years. I have this burst of some days, like 10, 20 days. And I have different TRs. So we thought, okay, this phenomena that we have is not limited to some specific time scale, or basically it's not just a multi-year or multi-day phenomena. So we have a burst, we have a mechanism that can explain this energetic burst that can basically, you can set the time scale. So we applied this model to fast radio bursts that are so much faster, as the name implies. Over some millisecond. So here, for the rest of my talk, I showed the examples that we have for the superiridience kind of application of superiridience model to FRBs. This is the work that Martin Wood mainly is leading. So, and we did this with his undergraduate student. So before I start talking about FRBs, I just summarize all the important thing and refresh our memories that what FRBs are. Fast radio bursts are, as the name implies, are very short duration bursts on the scale of few milliseconds, some millisecond. That's the time scale of the burst. They are very energetic, few Jansky to 100 Jansky. They have very large spectral bandwidth, for example. For 1.4 gigahertz FRB, the bandwidth is on the order of 100 megahertz. They think that they have extragalactic sources. We think that they have extragalactic sources because when you look at this FRB burst, you basically see that you can measure the dispersion measurements, and you see that this large dispersion measurement that you see for FRBs, they cannot be interpreted by galactic kind of DMs that we see. So they must have, like we think there is some contribution from like intergalactic DMs that shows that they are basically emitted very far away, and they have propagated through this cold plasma and accumulated this DM. The other main point is that I didn't put it here, the DMs that they measure, they cannot be purely produced through this propagation in the cold diffuse plasma. So they think a lot of this DM is produced where the FRB is originated. The other thing is, if you look at the FRB bursts, you see that different frequencies, they arrive at different times. So there's a delay time for FRB bursts. And the other part is, like, if you look at the temporal width of FRBs, you see that there is some relation with the frequency kind of that goes as inverse of frequency. For extragalactic sources, that they basically, the radiation interacts with cold plasma and it experiences this multi-pad scattering, what we observe is that the signal is going to arrive, like the higher frequencies are going to arrive faster, and the temporal width for those higher frequencies is going to be basically smaller. This is what you would expect naturally based for some radiation that has basically gone through multipath scattering. The other thing is that up to now, upward of 20, almost 30 FRBs are detected, but we expect that every 10 seconds, one FRB it should be detectable with the new instrument. But the main thing is nobody still knows what is the source or the nature of these FRBs. So here, we basically try to kind of explain these FRBs with the superidience model out of all the models that exist. So before I show some FRB data, I just show this basically kind of delay that we see for different frequencies. As you can see, different frequencies of FRB, they arrive at different time as basically this kind of one over like a frequency square that we see, the well-known kind of behavior that we have for large DMs that basically show propagation in cold diffuse plasma. And the width, as you can see, as I go to higher frequencies, is smaller. So they take these FRB data, as I showed an example, the example of like a spectrum. They take these FRB data and they try to de-disperse it. In 2015-16, Ravi et al. Did some analysis on these broadband FRBs. The example is 150807. They took the FRB spectra and they dispersed it. So what they saw is, although we have this kind of 1.4 gigahertz, and as you can see, it has this 100 megahertz bandwidth, when they did the dispersion analysis, they saw that the correlation only exists within small kind of bandwidths, like over 100 kilohertz. So if you look at the whole spectra, this 100 megahertz, it doesn't show this correlation, only over 100 kilohertz. The spectra showed some correlation. And why is that important? Because if the underlying, like the correlated beam in the spectra is smaller, it indicates that the time scale, the underlying time scale of FRBs is basically different, it's so much smaller. So if I have 100 kilohertz correlation, inverse it, so it's 10 to the 5, 10 to the minus 5, so the temporal width of those bursts that basically they have, the FRBs have, it should be on the order of 10 microseconds instead of millisecond. So we took this, and we knew all this basically behavior about the delay, the tails, the shape, and everything, and the kind of the intensity spikes. So we applied the superidience model to see basically if we can explain the kind of behavior that they observe. Here I show the data for FRB 110220 detected in 2011. So on the top, we have this flux versus time in millisecond that I show the black dots that are the data, and I show our fit indicated as blue line. The fit parameters are listed here and they are different from what you saw for the masers. So naturally I go from multi-day or multi-year to multi-second bursts, so I expect different time scales. So the burst here, the fit here is produced again using the similar mechanism. So we think that we have this long region that the length is on the order of 280 AU, a few hundred AU, and we have this inversion in this time and length scale. So the population of this sample is inverted with some mechanism, and then through some kind of change in the pump, you can basically increase the number of inverted atoms, like double or triple it there. And by increasing the number of the inverted atoms and increasing the column density, you basically decrease your the time scale of your superidience. And that can result basically in the coherent radiation of this large sample. So here we are speaking about like 10 to the 30 atoms or molecules that they are emitting together to produce this intensity. And as you can see, my fit can very well capture the kind of the shape or the behavior of this burst, and using like a column densities that are basically 10 to the 7 per centimeter square, and the densities of like 0.1 atom per centimeter cube. So the main differences here are, as you can see, the number of inverted atoms, the density of inverted atoms is higher than what I showed for masers. So these are like a relatively high density mediums, because there I had like 10 to the minus 12 per centimeter cube. Here I have 10 to the minus 2. So in this relatively high density medium, where I have like the kind of, if I can basically establish coherence, I can reproduce bursts like that can basically change the flux from like a few orders of magnitude over millisecond. So the main thing here is it is difficult to produce bursts that like to have this energetic burst to change of few Jansky over few millisecond. That's the main difficulty of explaining how FRBs are basically reproduced. The other thing is, if you look at the temporal width of this, and if I kind of show you the TR here, the TR that we have is going to be on the order of few microseconds. So if you kind of inverse that few microsecond temporal width for this superridian sample that I have, this translates to a few hundred kilohertz that we see for the correlation in this spectral kind of dedispersed spectra. And we already know that the population inversion can be achieved over length scale of like a few hundred AU, as is the case for mega masers that are already detected around AGNs or other kind of extragalactic sources. So this fit is produced in the pump mode, meaning that I showed that I have some inversion and I increase the level of inversion and I kind of see the burst. We can actually think of another scenario too, that you have some level of inversion in this medium and then there's a trigger signal that kind of propagates through the medium. And that trigger signal basically triggers the coherent behavior here. The parameters for this fit, again, are very similar to the pump mode that I had. The length is 290 AU, almost the same. It's very similar width. And the dephasing times that I have here are on the order of second, yeah? These dephasing times that you see here, they are mainly corresponding to the Doppler broadening that we have in that kind of environment. So it's similar dephasing time I had in the pump mode. So we think that there are two ways you can see this. We know that we can establish population inversion over this large scale kind of samples that we have. It can be that there is some change in the pump that is inverting the population that can trigger basically this burst, or there can be like a background signal that is basically propagating and triggering FRBs. So any of that, these scenarios can basically explain the intensity that we see, the time scale of the burst, and basically can show how energy can be released over such a small time scale, using this.
Sorry, I have two questions. One is, how far is this supposed to be?
How far the source?
Yeah.
So here you see that the trigger that I'm using, the amplitude is 10 to the minus nanovolt, it's 10 to the minus 10 watt kind of per meter square. So what happens is that we think that this amplitude translates to, for example, pulsar radiation. You can see that the pulsar can, in 1 kiloparsec, it can basically produce 1 Jansky kind of radiation that basically is equivalent to what I'm using here. So we think a pulsar in the background or nearby, some should be able to kind of to trigger this, but Martin probably
saying,
knows.
So you're saying it's not the cosmological or galactic source, like the dispersion measures.
The dispersion measure.
In situ. So the argument I will argue, right? I mean, so your dispersion measure will be in situ created, essentially, not the propagation.
Yeah. So the dispersion measure, this is not a, there is no, you know, almost people are certain that the dispersion measures that we have for FRBs are not produced only by propagation through the cold plasma, because the numbers are really large. And no propagation in cold plasma can produce that dispersion measure. So we are sure that most of this dispersion is produced in the location of the source. So our explanation here is that you basically the shape or the kind of width or the correlation that you see in the bandwidth is the result of basically this underlying coherent phenomenon. Because the samples, they have like 10 microsecond time scale. So the bandwidth that I will get, the correlation that I would get from one single superradiant sample is like 100 kilohertz. So the dispersion measure that they kind of have and all other models that they actually agreed to, it cannot be all produced just by propagation. Most of it is intrinsic.
But I mean, for some, I think at least for one of our people have identified them in their source galaxy, which is...
Yeah, it's a redshift of 0.2. It's the repeating.
It's redshift 1.2.
Yeah.
The Earth is 560.
Yeah.
Also the repeated one, right? That's the one.
That's there is one repeating FRB, and because it repeats, so they could do the observation many times.
But you're saying it's the parts.
No, that's the source behind, that's the trigger around the FRB location. Not kiloparsec. So imagine that you have your FRB somewhere, so I need a trigger close by.
How far is, I mean, to get the flux that we observe, FRB is how far?
No, the redshift only for one source is known.
But in this model, so you have to assume a distance to it, right?
We are assuming a distance from basically the trigger from the source.
This is assumed to be at 1 gigaparsec.
1 gigaparsec. Okay.
1 gigaparsec.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So how do you do the rates? Because you're asking that the relative densities, it's on the high side.
Yeah.
But then you're saying this is a very common occurrence.
The velocity.
You have too high a rate.
No, we don't have this density that I list here. It's for the whole velocity span. Yeah, and if you calculate the Doppler broadening and everything for that, so you can basically choose the velocity beam that is corresponding to your FRB that you have here.
So what in Raptor, so you have a kind of an environment that, given you trigger superradiance, you're going to say it's going to be explaining the FRB, but the environment is. Right, it's there. It's going to be doing
this. I am only asking, so the assumption here is that you have inversion of one atom per centimeter cube for 10 kilometers per second span, yeah?
Right.
And then because the span that I want, so 10 kilometers per second is going to translate to like 1,000 kilohertz.
So it's about
kilohertz.
One per cubic centimeters for velocity span of a population spreading about 1 kilometer per second. So that's a typical Maser environment. It's not
yeah.
Special.
Sure, okay. But then, so in the standard way of the rate of FRBs are high, relatively high. But then in the standard model, you call for a particular, say, a magnetar bursting or something like that happens one every now and then. So there is a special thing that triggers it.
Yeah, cold start happens very
actually. So now you're asking for a special environment that would just have this coherent emission take place. But once you have the environment is there, it can be doing it all the time. So per site, something special had to happen to trigger it. Now the environment is special. So in that environment, I could have many instances of FRPs.
So it
would strike to me as though you're going to have a problem with rate side, that you're going to have a very high rate of FRPs.
That's correct, and I think, but I kind of need to clarify more. There is this repeating FRB, and there are other FRBs that they are not repeating because they do follow-up observation. First of all, we don't know if there is only one mechanism behind all FRBs. There can be two classes. It can be a class for repeaters, and it can be the class for non-repeaters. Here I showed the pump mode and the trigger mode. If I have a trigger and that trigger is there and it keeps constantly triggering it, as long as the inversion is there and the inversion can be maintained, it can repeat, as you say. But if, for example, I have a pump mode and there is some kind of change in the environment, for example, some shocks, yeah, some kind of one-time event that happens in the environment and basically increases the inversion, so you can see this first. If the pump, it basically doesn't spike and it doesn't increase the inversion one more time to that level, it's not going to repeat. So for example, I know from a star-forming regions that, for example, for water masers, there are these shock winds So you have these older stars and they are dying, so they kind of eject the mass, and that kind of results in some shocks. They pump your masers, but it happens once, yeah? So depending on what kind of, it, yes, I'm asking for some specific kind of condition, but I did not say that this condition will be maintained forever. Because some.
I understand that I'm not pushing back, I'm just trying to play the labels out of it. So in the standard way that people are trying to explain this for reason, the fact that we don't have a good answer means, okay, all the answers are good to be explored. But there, it's like they have everything in a unique sense. So I need the object, and the object will be doing everything.
Yeah.
So here you cannot separate it. You need the trigger, and I need the environment. So somehow, the environment will be the magic ingredient to explain these particular features. But you have detached yourself from the trigger, because the trigger will now have to be doing the job to explain the rates.
It doesn't have to be trigger, because for my masers, there was only pump that was basically pushing the critical density, the column density above the critical column density. And in FRBs, the first one that I showed you is just the fit is produced with no trigger and only a change in the pump.
Fine, but
this can be a transient phenomenon.
Many. So that's, if it is too easy to make them, then you might overproduce them with the rates. So it's possible.
How many mega masers do we have?
That's a different system.
Yeah, but because they require similar inversion over similar length scale, not many. So?
Okay, maybe I'm still a bit confused. But I think this is a collective phenomenon, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it will behave a bit like avalanches. So you have your mountain and it builds up a steady accumulation of snow, and that will be the analog of having your population inversion. And as that happens, it gets more and more unstable, right? And eventually something will set it off, right? And it might be that yesterday the exact same stimulus did not set it off. But today somebody fires a gun or whatever it is people do around snowy mountains that triggers avalanches, and then the whole lot comes down in a big rush. And then after that, the resource is depleted, so you can have the same trigger coming in from outside and nothing will happen. You
have
to wait for the reset time.
If the inversion is not there, then the trigger can't basically trigger it on its own. Because the trigger is there and it's propagating and it's not doing anything to the environment unless the environment has the right basically set of like the inversion condition that as we see. So as you mentioned, it's correct. So we have this kind of density, the inversion in the environment, and somehow by change in the pump condition in the environment, the inversion is basically increased above the critical level. And then we can have superradiance, but superradiance is very efficient releasing energy, yeah? So it kind of quickly depletes all the level and you go below that critical thing. And then you need another spike and even harder to bring it back to where you were. So depending on how fast you deplete the population of the levels. But the trigger, as you see here, I have some kind of inversion here already going on before the trigger. And the inversion I use here is a little higher than the inversion that I had for the pump mode, slightly higher. So if the trigger comes in and I have the right inversion, then it can basically trigger and it can kind of set the time scale of my burst. But this is not the only way that this can happen.
We do see giant pulses from crab once in a while. Is that kind of trigger is sufficient for you? In the case of you're saying there's a pulsar behind whatever the inversion region you're talking about?
This amplitude, basically electric field for the trigger that we are asking is nothing weird, nothing extraordinary about it. We have these different sources that in catalogs, and we can basically see that, as you say, pulsars or other sources, depending on how far away they are around the source, they can basically supply this kind of trigger this. So depending on the distance and the type of the source, they can act as a trigger. But the main thing is, look at the time scale of the trigger. It's short. That might supply the energy, that might have the right amplitude, but it should have the right time scale. Pulsars have no problem. That's the time scale of pulsar bursts. and they can, they have the right amplitudes.
Yeah, but the JN pulses are not that often, so the,
yeah,
you know, that may be consistent with the rate, you know, he was talking about that.
Yeah.
So there may not be too many.
Related to this question, can you take this model for FRBs and then back out a expected rate for these triggers, whether they're shocks or...
Yes, that's what
like
you are doing. You take the...
some particular astrophysical event?
Yeah.
See if the rates match.
So you're basically looking at the data, making the fit, and it gives us some information about the trigger or the pump. It also gives some information about the column density of the environment. It provides some information about the environment that can be tested, but about the rate of this event, that if I can make a prediction that if it's going to happen again and when, then I need more information. For example, I can kind of propose some candidates for the trigger, yeah, that it should have this, meet this requirement here. But we need to kind of study the environment and see if any of that matches with this. And when, depending on the nature of the source, then you can kind of, we have some knowledge about how often it repeats. But the model on its own, if it can kind of say it has happened and if it's going to happen again, so I think there is more work there.
Might this model predict some spectrum, either in spectral width or just in the time the FRB goes on or the luminosity, based on what the ambient number density is of your emitting and absorbing atoms? In other words, you've set your number density to 0.01 centimeter per centimeter cubed. If I change that, would that change the expected features of this person?
So if you change the density, yeah? So here, the main thing, more than density, is the column density that it, you see. It always, I refer to that column density, and I should have done it correctly from the start, saying that it's the column density. So let's say that there's a change in the density, or there's a change in the column density. The change in the column density is going to change TR. It's going to change the time scale of your burst, and it's going to change the, basically, spectral kind of bandwidth that you see the correlation. Yes. It depends on that too, but it's not just the density, it's the column density. So I have here the kind of the main parameter that I report here is the column density. So if the, you set the density to a different number, you're going to get a slightly different length. Yeah?
Sure. So does that mean that we have to predict that, you know, these environments hit very particular parameters so that we don't see a large spectrum of different sorts of FRBs? I mean, because the FRBs we see are fairly consistent.
So the fits tell you what's the column density of your environment, yeah?
Yeah?
And then you can do some studies there. And for example, you know, put some limits on your density, if it can be more than this, if it can be, if it's a low density. So for example, here it's telling us that it's a high density medium comparing to what I showed you before. But I think no model on its own can answer all the questions. So you, anyway, you need to study the environment to basically have the complete picture. Because as I told you, what comes out of the model, if you give me the burst, if you give me the time scale of the burst and the spectral correlation, I can give you the column density. But then we need to make sure that, you know, the density is basically tested and see the density so we can kind of...
You roughly know the number density of mega masers in the sense of in the local universe. Is that sufficient for you, or?
Yes. Yes, we are not, here I'm not asking for more than what we would need for a mega maser.
To explain the expected or observed dates, these numbers are sufficient?
Yes, they are sufficient.
And then if they have a, can I imagine that this can also happen within the galaxy too then?
So FRBs?
Mm-hmm.
So
I mean, if I have some Strafford regions with sufficient, you know, masing action, then technically if the supports are behind it.
So mega masers, they are
within the galaxy,
yeah.
You need mega maser,
yeah,
structure or something.
So inside the galaxy, if you can have the mega maser, and if you basically have the length scale for the mega maser, sure. But I still need to do more like a kind of a reading on this, but the last time I looked into mega masers, they were mostly extragalactic.
Yeah, they are like AGN and water.
Yes. So the point is, mega masers, they are like 10 to the 6 times stronger than masers. They require like larger length, and that is better, like, you know, kind of facilitated in like extragalactic sources around some specific kind of like galaxies. It may not be kind of facilitated in our galaxy, but if there is a possibility to see mega masers, I would say, why not? If I have the length scale, if I have the inversion, why not? But I am not aware of a mega maser inside our galaxy. So just to summarize the discussion, supergradients is a coherent phenomena. It's like it's a burst-like phenomena, and it happens over a wide range of time scale. I showed you years, days, and I showed you some seconds, millisecond, microsecond. So nothing limits supergradients as long as we basically have the requirements out there for the inversion and velocity coherence. It has been observed in different experimental kind of settings, in different wavelengths in the lab. And we showed some examples for like 6.7 gigahertz and water 22. I forgot to take out OH 6 and 12 megahertz because we had many examples of that in this study. And we think that it can provide a simple explanation for FRB mystery, not asking for too much. And actually comparing to other models for FRB, basically, they have difficulty explaining the observed intensities. They are short by like 8-10 orders of magnitude. They have hard time. Basically, the ones that the most famous one is the magnetar, and they cannot basically reproduce the intensities that they see. And we basically observe some kind of the behavior that for different FRBs at different frequencies, the bandwidth is showing some kind of behavior that you can't only explain it with scintillation and dispersion measure basically through this multipath scattering. So each model is doing its own kind of share, like some they do better in this aspect, some they do better in other aspects. But we think that our model can capture the time scales, the intensities, even some kind of polarization and other features with a simple explanation. So that's it. Thank you very much. Any questions?
I think we need one to ask a question.
No,
you're very puzzled.
There is no magnetar person or pulsar person here. They always, they must object. So I'm kind of waiting for that.
I think everybody likes your explanation of FRB as a joke.
I guess there are a lot of questions.
Thank you.